Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined tonight for a discussion of A Hard Day's Night by the biggest Beatlemaniac I know, JB.
Okay, we have to stop right there. I think that falls under fair use. The Apple lawyers are famously litigious. I don't want to get sued.
Remember, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. You should do it. Follow us on Twitter at fthismovie. Like us on Facebook. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And, of course, it's June, so what should you all be doing?
Junesploitation, sir!
That's exactly right. We have our first ever Junesploitation going on 30 days, celebrating exploitation movies. So go to fthismovie.net, look for the Junesploitation tab at the top of the page, assuming this is your first time ever hearing this show, and find out more about it.
And we're not going far afield tonight, this afternoon, this morning, because actually, in a very real way, this is an exploitation film.
Yeah, I was going to go there.
Which we'll get into, and I have not yet memorized the categories.
Oh, come on, I haven't either.
Obviously,
I literally barely even know what tomorrow is.
There's the revenge aspect when Paul gets sick of his grandfather and murders him.
Yeah.
That's in the director's cut. There's really not, well, there's a car. They all get in a car.
True.
And Paul's grandfather says, I came with you to get a change of scenery, and all I've seen is a train in a room, and a car in a room, and a room in a room. So maybe you should save this for the day devoted to rooms.
Also, George Harrison is a zombie.
Oh, wow. That didn't occur to me. Maybe you can use Hard Day's Night as one of your free spaces. It is an exploitation film, though.
Well, yeah, we have a rock and roll day. You can watch Hard Day's Night on rock and roll day.
I couldn't think of a better choice.
No, me either. Hey, before we talk about A Hard Day's Night and more about Junesploitation, Jay Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
I have. And again, I think I've brought this up before. I'd like to thank you because thanks to the other podcasts and the other correspondents, you guys have been saving me a lot of money lately.
That's what we're here for.
I think maybe I'll go to see, listen to podcast. No, save hard-earned money. So, oh, the things I've skipped. Oh, the things I've skipped. But yesterday, I was amazed and surprised that Francis Ha made it out to the suburbs, and it was in the very smallest screening room at our favorite multiplex. And for a long time during the pre-show, it was my lovely wife and I alone, which I love.
Yeah, right.
Because you can indulge the fantasy that this is your private screening
room.
And
then you get disappointed when people show up.
And people did show up, much older crowd.
A-holes.
Well, two of them were, and you've noticed this, and we've talked about this. Literally every other seat in the theater is full, but we are tribal primates, and we have to be in a group around the fire. This couple comes in and sits right behind us.
But, I mean, are people unable to observe?
It's weird, I tell you.
The law of urinals. You leave the one in the middle empty.
It's true.
Skip a row, people.
I always think it's my magnetic personality, but clearly this was an older crowd and a crowd who had read about the film. And I'd say by the time it started rolling, there were 10 of us there.
Wow.
So I was just surprised that it made it out to the suburbs so quickly. It is the new film by Noah Baumbach, and it is in black and white, which I think they're keeping out the down low, but, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's one of the best films I've seen this year so far.
Cool.
Will fill your head with ideas. It doesn't insult your intelligence. It does a lot of show don't tell, which I like. Wonderful performance by Greta Gerwig and a whole bunch of other people I sort of know kind of from little TV parts. I have never seen Girls. Although I think Francis Ha...
The TV show.
Yes.
Not the gender.
Oh, the range of jokes that springs into my head. No, I've not seen the Tiny Furniture Woman's little HBO show. Apparently it's groundbreaking, but I have no desire to watch a half an hour of navel gazing every week. So, and I'm too old. It's creepy. But apparently someone who's on that show... who I've read about, is also in Francis Ha. Would it be Adam Driver?
That is a name from a person who is on Girls.
He is a tall, hulking presence.
Yes.
He sort of comes across as a bullying intellectual.
He was in Lincoln as well, I believe.
Yeah. So, if it makes it out to you, if it's on, on demand within a week, I would seek it out. It's very much worth your time. It was so much better than I thought. And once again, I walked in knowing nothing.
Yeah, I know nothing except that it's in black and white. It's directed by Noah Baumbach, and Greta Gerwig is in it.
It's very entertaining. I can't wait for you to see it, because I have no idea how you will react.
Okay. All right. Anything besides Francis Ha?
Oh, my Lord. Because I couldn't pass up the Thursday night. Oh, I wasn't going to a movie. Now I'm going to a movie. After enjoying a delightful choral concert by a certain progeny of a certain F this movie proprietor, I went to see Hangover 3, and you discussed this. Because yeah. It got a lot of comments. You discussed this.
Yeah, most of the comments were about Hangover 3.
It was weird. It was like, you know, they're actually talking about this other thing. It makes you lament the human race. It was so bad. And as you pointed out, and as a lot of people pointed out, the biggest problem, no jokes.
Yeah.
If there were jokes, you could excuse the skeevy stuff. But without jokes, it's just skis.
Yeah, what a weird movie.
Oh, and I went to see Cannibal Holocaust.
Yes.
At the midnight show, right. At the Music Box.
More jokes than Hangover Part 3.
I actually thought I thought it was more honest than that, that they really killed animals, not just the CGI bullshit. When I go, that, man, there's no apology for that film.
I still have never seen it.
You don't?
No.
In the words of, what's his name and his crew from Grindhouse, don't! I sat there and like at 12:15, I'm like, why did I do this? Although, as my son pointed out, I had sort of lost this thing because I hadn't been there at midnight. This was the Music Box, which is, once again, the happiest place on earth. They're remodeling the second screen.
Yeah, I saw some preview pictures.
New seats.
Yeah.
That's the key. So that's exciting. And that when you go to the midnight show, the horrible situation on the highway that we take to get there doesn't exist. So I got there in less than a half an hour, which is, oh, so much better than it taking an hour.
Yeah.
So I concluded, well, I'll continue to go to the Music Box, but only at midnight.
I saw a movie called Nature Calls, starring Patton Oswalt and Johnny Knoxville and Patrice O'Neill.
I've read about this.
It's garbage.
Oh, yeah.
It reminded me a lot of Hangover 3, actually, in that there don't appear to be any jokes, and it's weirdly mean-spirited, and then tries to be very sentimental at the end. Seems like it. I believe it was shelved for a couple years. Seems like it went through some massive edits because things don't make sense. I think it's like 79 minutes long, which is usually an indication that
it's been seemed cut. To me that Patton did it to be a good sport. And now that you've seen this masterpiece, you can answer my question: is he in it a lot?
Not that much.
That's what I thought. Because when it was finally released, he was prominently featured in the advertising.
Yeah, my guess is everybody signed on to make a movie that is not the movie that was released.
He's a scoutmaster, right?
Correct. Leading some scouts, and he takes it very seriously. And then his brother is Johnny Knoxville, who gets burned alive and crucified. And
I believe Johnny Knoxville crucified. And Patton Oswalt could have come out of the same mother. I can suspend my disbelief.
So that was not good. And going against your advice, I did. My curiosity got the better of me, and I saw what is on DVD referred to as only Texas Chainsaw.
Oh, yeah.
Because in the theater, it was Texas Chainsaw 3D.
That was the first movie I saw this year.
Yeah, they came out like the first week of January.
I'm at the movies. It's still Christmas break.
And it made a bunch of money the first weekend and then no money the second weekend. It's easily one of the worst movies of the year.
Shame on you.
I don't know if it was because of the 3D. It was way too bright, I thought, again, watching it at home.
In my experience in the theaters wearing the glasses, it was way too dark.
Right. I think they were trying to compensate by over-lighting everything, which doesn't work.
It satisfies no one.
It doesn't work in a horror movie. Some of the worst editing and sort of staging I've ever seen in a studio movie.
There's a scene in the basement where I think someone takes someone else's face off. It's very graphic and it's very special effecty, although practical special effects. He's ripping a rubber mask off a thing, yeah. And it's very, very bloody. And hold on, there was a point to this. Oh, you're talking about editing. It was edited in like they finished the film and the producer said, no, you got a 10-minute stretch here, Sonny. And that it was made by a separate filmmaker, because I've seen movies like this from the 60s where there's these inserts like, there's 10 minutes without titty. I'm telling you, they're coming to see titty. That it really seemed like it was cut in from another film. I completely agree with you. The editing was horrible.
There's only sporadic sort of gore throughout the movie, but it's repellent. I mean, it's really hardcore, the few moments of violence that we get. But here's a horror movie that's so incompetent that I'm going to spoil a little bit of Texas Chainsaw. At least two of the characters, there's essentially four main characters, sort of the group of teenagers. Half of them aren't killed by Leatherface one dies in a car accident. Like, it's garbage. And I really was just watching because I knew it got to this crazy moment.
Patrick saw this film for one line.
I really did, hoping that it would have earned that moment.
I could have taken you into a dark room and said the line.
But I needed to see the movie that got to that point.
And saved you 2 hours
and
of
it,
your
it,
life.
It didn't live up to the do your thing, cuz.
Between Texas Chainsaw and Evil Dead. We're on a road to nowhere, mister.
I think Evil Dead, and I didn't like Evil Dead, I think Evil Dead is a much better movie than Texas Chainsaw.
Yes, if I'm holding this pile of shit in my left hand, oh, and yeah. I'm holding this pile of shit in my right hand, I prefer the pile of shit in my right hand.
I didn't like either one, but I could say one is better. And is that it? Yeah, and then some stuff for Junesploitation.
Also, at your suggestion, I finally sat down and watched American Grindhouse on Netflix, because yes. I had never seen it. And it's terrific, but I had a quibble.
It's the same talking heads that are in everything?
Well, that's certain people will do these documentaries and certain people won't. I thought it needed to be longer.
Yeah.
It's so segmented,
yeah.
And you get so sick of the thing where the film breaks and it burns on screen. It's like,
the new category.
Could you come up with something else for the film to do? I've seen film do all sorts of things. Just when they really start discussing the subtopic, it goes on to the next one.
Right.
And you're like, well, no, you were just about to... No, sorry, gotta keep going.
Right.
Gotta keep going. It's not 90 minutes.
It is too short, and it doesn't get enough into sort of the 70s and 80s when things really exploded. It's neat that it gives you this background that goes all the way back to basically the invention of film. And like, boy, as soon as they were making movies, they were making exploitation movies, which is cool, but it doesn't really get into the explosion that happened in the 70s and 80s.
That would have been good. I would have preferred fewer subtopics.
Right.
And for them to actually have some conversations with these people, because it's almost as if that becomes the editing principle. When they really start bringing up something thought-provoking...
Cut away!
That's when we go on to the next shallow
There was
topic.
A lot of time spent on Herschel Gordon Lewis, again, whose
because
movies...
Because they got him.
Right. And whose movies I'm not a fan of, although listening to him interviewed is fun. And I understand his contribution, which is, I mean, he sort of invented, like, hey, what if we make this horrible and bloody?
And we brought this up because at one of the massacres, he was the guest, and we got to see Wizard of Gore.
Concentrate.
I've come to the conclusion that the key...
Concentrate!
The key to understanding Herschel Gordon Lewis is to know that once he abandoned filmmaking for whatever reason, he became the king of direct mail. He wrote books, he would consult to people, and he made millions of dollars because he had these ways to do direct mail to make a lot of money. He made a lot of money. That this even comes out in his interviews in American Grindhouse. Clearly, he was there for one reason, to make money. That's why those films exist. There's no pretense of art. In fact, right. He says, we noticed this, and we said, what if you did this?
Yeah.
And it was a goldmine.
He doesn't take it very seriously. He doesn't think of himself as an artist. He recognizes that his movies aren't very good. And, I mean, there's kind of a cynicism to that I can't totally get behind. He's not Ed Wood, you know, who lived and died by these movies.
a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago, I finally got to meet David Friedman, who's now passed away. And he was like one of the most interesting people I've ever met. And we had this really great long conversation. He was very generous with his time. And he actually published his autobiography, at least the first volume of it, which I recommend. Probably have to get it as a used book now. It's called A Youth in Babylon. And it's all about those early days distributing films with the 40 Thieves. And at the end of the book, he promised a second one. And when he passed away, that was everyone's first question. Did he finish part two? Because part
one is... My first question, was he murdered?
By a man who was trying to do an Egyptian feast. That apparently he didn't finish the book, which is a shame. Because A Youth in Babylon is an amazing book, which I recommend to everyone. Now, what was my last book recommendation?
The Bible, right? At least once a podcast, you recommend that we read the Bible?
All of life's answers are contained in Leviticus. I think we've discussed this. No, I believe the last official book recommendation was The Making of Wizard of Oz by Al Jean Harmetz. And since then, it's been a while.
Yeah.
A lot of people have read it.
Yeah.
And you see what I'm talking. I don't do this lightly.
Right.
A Youth in Babylon by David Friedman. It's amazing.
All right. Cool. Should we talk about A Hard Day's Night?
Let's talk about the Beatles.
All right, so it's June. It's June-sploitation, and as JB mentioned at the start of the podcast, this movie has sort of, it's beloved. It's been elevated to classic status. It's often referred to as one of the best musicals of the last 100 years. Rarely is it talked about as an exploitation movie, and that's not why we picked it, but it just kind of worked out. Oh, hey, wait. This is an exploitation movie. It's here to exploit the Beatles' popularity and teenagers' love of rock and roll music.
And that's a good way in, because there's a documentary that the producers of the latest iteration of A Hard Day's Night were not smart enough to include. I don't know what it was originally produced for. I know for a long time PBS used to show it during pledge drives, so it would be interrupted every 10 minutes with appeals for money. And it was put together by David Leaf, who's done a lot of rock and roll documentaries. And it was called You Can't Do That. And it's terrific, and if you can track it down, you should.
It's probably on YouTube.
Everything broken into little eight-minute segments. Right.
Although now they put full stuff up on it.
It's well worth your time. It's only about an hour long. And, again, the producers of the latest Beatles-approved edition were so hot to do their own supplementary features, which are broken up into hundreds of little tiny 5-minute chapters. They should have just paid for the rights to You Can't Do That. Walter Shenson, who has since passed away, is interviewed extensively and talks at great length, according to my students, at too much length, about the genesis of this film. And basically what happened is, in February of 1964, the Beatles appear on Ed Sullivan 5 Sundays in a row, which was sort of a new thing. And they were so popular that by April, they held a position on the Billboard Top 100 sales charts that no other artist had ever done. And as far as I know, no other artist had ever done. They had positions 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. They had the 5 top-selling records in the country on the Billboard charts, as well as a couple other sundry positions further down the chart. So United Artists realized that even though Capitol had the rights to release Beatles albums in the United States, if they made a Beatles movie, any Beatles movie, they would have the right to release the soundtrack album. And that's why this film exists. And Shenson's very honest in the documentary. He says, that seemed like a noble enough reason to make a film, and I agreed to produce the film. It cost them $580,000, and quite a bargain.
Yeah, right.
And it was shot over 7 weeks. So this is the essence of exploitation.
Yeah.
But I think the Beatles did one thing right. The Beatles, remember, were rock and roll fans, and they all loved Elvis, and they had all seen Elvis movies, and they had all seen lesser rock and roll films. And in every documentary ever made about them, they always say the same thing. We didn't want to make a shitty rock and roll movie where we show up at the end as the band.
Right.
And this reminds me of The Wonders in That Thing You Do.
Kevin Beach and the Shrimp Shack Shooters.
I'm so impressed that you can summon that from memory.
I know that movie by heart.
That they're inserted in the end. Because earlier we were talking about beach party movies. And beach party movies, oh, here's little Stevie Wonder. And they show up and they do one song. The Beatles said we didn't want to do that. So they hired Alan Owen, who was a playwright, to come with them on tour and sort of absorb what it was like. And he wrote this script that's really interesting for a number of reasons. It's certainly unlike any film in 1964. Do you find that there are things in the script that are sort of too precious by half?
Sure. The movie is a series of 30-second bits.
Yes.
The whole movie. You kind of think like, oh, this pace will calm down eventually. Nope.
No.
30-second bits, big concert at the end.
And Richard Lester even said he thought that if he could make it sort of little things that they could do, because they weren't professional actors, that the Beatles themselves would be better served by that. So it is very...
Right.
What's the word? It's in little tiny pieces. And what I've always said... Because I show this in class every semester for almost 30 years. I've seen this film a lot of times. That it goes for an hour. It goes for about an hour with no plot. And then it's like, I think we need a plot.
There's still barely a plot.
And
it's just like,
Ringo,
get on stage.
Ringo runs away for 10 minutes. It's pretty much as close as you can come to plotless. If you examine it, the stitching, the carpentry becomes apparent that that we have this loose structure where they're rehearsing for a television appearance and they have to do run-throughs, which gives you excuse for musical numbers, and all this crazy stuff can happen backstage. It'd be interesting to look at this as a backstage musical and sort of compare it to 42nd Street or something. But there's one scene for each Beatle where it was deliberately planned out that George wanders into that office and makes fun of the girl who's on the TV show. And John has that amazing scene with Anna Quayle,
yeah,
who later shows up as the queen of the king in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, the king who wants all the toys for himself with
the
kid catcher.
I've never seen Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I almost bought it for $5 a couple weeks ago.
It's like a 3-minute scene where she thinks he's him.
Yeah.
But... he's not, it's just nonsense for 3 minutes. It's great. And Ringo, of course, goes off and has that scene where he wanders off. By the way, in the Beatles anthology, Ringo said he received such accolades for that scene. And they were saying, oh, you were such a good actor. You were so melancholy. And finally, when they did the documentary, the Beatles anthology, he admitted he had stayed out all night. And he was really hungover. And he now thinks that was a bad idea. But he said that performance in that scene is informed by the fact that I felt like shit.
That's what led to Caveman.
Hey, I saw Caveman on its original release in a drive-in. or at a drive-in. But the one thing I just wanted to say is if you watch the carpentry of the movie, you'll notice that Paul's scene is missing. They filmed a scene where Paul wanders off, goes to a rehearsal room, and sort of has this scene where he flirts with this ballerina, and Lester thought it slowed down the film, which seems odd when you consider how that would have gone over in the audience that originally saw the film.
Right.
There's a scene early in the train where Paul stands up and combs his hair into a mirror in the train compartment, and I've read that if you saw this in 1964... you literally couldn't hear the dialogue for 3 minutes because him combing his hair just led to this thing of screams.
The movie is fascinating. And my mom has told me stories about going to see this movie in 1964 and staying to watch it all day because you could just sit in the theater and they would run it again and you would sit there like Don Draper seeing Planet of the Apes, like, hey, you want to see it again? So she would just sit and watch it all day. And the movie sort of at once exploits the Beatles while also sort of cementing... not their legacy, but sort of defines who they are and each of their roles.
Danny Perry points out that it sort of commodified them and established what they were like. Later, when the Beatles broke up, Lennon was very bitter. He published that epic Rolling Stone interview where he just shit on everyone. But he said what he really objected to was there's a scene where the managers... make them stay in at night and answer fan mail, as if they ever did that. And the four Beatles wander off. They play hooky and they go to a nightclub where they're seen drinking and smoking and talking and dancing. And then the managers come back and sort of pull them away and make them, like, he really objected to the fact that, that they were being portrayed this way right. as sort of children
right.
who had to be led around, and he didn't like that at all.
Because so much of, I feel like, what the movie is about is sort of this youthful spirit of, like, kind of like, fuck you, adults, you know?
Right, but I think it's a safe and comfortable fuck you.
It is.
Because think about it. When the Beatles finally break free,
yeah.
which Lester had even said he knew should be about halfway through the film, they just run around in an open field
yeah.
because their existence is so...
Right. Yeah, it's not like they don't go murdering people. It's not The Purge. They don't go murdering people.
I'd like to see that movie where they break free and they murder a homeless man.
Or like three of their stories the exact same. But like Ringo strangles a bum.
Don't worry about it, Paul. They'll never suspect us.
But it is interesting because we love the Beatles so much and they are so sort of charming and likable. I was watching the movie today thinking about, boy, if I didn't like the Beatles, or if this movie, this same movie, was focusing on a different band, somebody contemporary, if this was Justin Bieber, who I can't stand, if he had all the same lines, whatever, I would just think he was an insufferable dick. Like, John Lennon at points, I think, could come off as an insufferable dick in this movie, if you don't like him. But we love John Lennon, and we love the Beatles, so we're like, haha, we're on your side, John. You're hilarious and charming, even though you can't give a straight answer to anything.
It struck me, and lately it does, that I'm showing this film to my students, and next year, this film turns 50.
Wow.
And that this would have been like my film studies instructor in high school showing me a movie from the
20s. Yeah.
And how would I have reacted? We're seeing a film this week with Rudy Valli. He was quite the sensation with his little megaphone. But maybe you can't compare them because, by and large, my students come in. They are familiar with the Beatles, and for the most part, they love the Beatles. The Beatles, if anything, are more beloved now than when I started teaching, when you had the schism that you either liked them or hated them. For the most part now, I get kids who love them or are indifferent.
Right. Should we take a brief autobiographical pause? Because I don't know if you've ever talked about this on the podcast, your relationship with the Beatles. I don't mean like
the fact that they used to pass you around. Oh, you. Yours is so much more tawdry than mine.
Whatever.
Mine is a loving relationship, and you're just...
Beatles pulled a train on JB. I'll say it.
What are you talking about?
Well, just, you're like the biggest Beatles fan in the world. I thought you should, you know,
okay.
disclose that.
Before I get into that, how did you see this film?
On DVD.
Okay, so you own it.
Or with my eyes. Is this a trick question?
No, it's not a trick
question. I own it, yes.
Because for a time it was on Netflix.
Oh.
And now it's not on Netflix anymore.
Okay, I own it and watched it on DVD.
And you're talking about the silvery gray box version
disc, yes.
that's impossible. I wanted to bring this up because Apple, which is still the Beatles company, and they do everything wrong because you get four voices that are always in competition. Help is coming out on Blu-ray. In 3 weeks, which is very exciting. And for those of you listening to the podcast, if you're a little wily, you can actually access A Hard Day's Night on Blu-ray, though not in the United States. It's available in Canada, and it's either Region 1 or Region 3, so you can show it and not feel bad. And that's the version I've been showing lately in class. And this semester, I had a student who was really into the Beatles. I didn't know this until I started showing it. And after day one, you know, the lights come up, and everyone's filing out of the room. And she turns to me and she says, I've never seen it look like this. And I think this was the first time in class I've used the Blu-ray. And I said, yeah, I was sort of standing in the back of the room observing that. So the new Blu-ray looks so good that people notice who are familiar with the film, and you can get it. Because Apple has a miserable record of releasing Beatles things. Help is coming out on Blu-ray. That's exciting. The Yellow Submarine Blu-ray is beautiful and has all these little gewgaws inside of it. And Magical Mystery Tour came out recently. We're all waiting for Let It Be.
Yeah.
And apparently Let It Be is a sore spot. So we're not going to get Let It Be in my lifetime. However, Let It Be is available in little 8-minute chunks on the YouTube, so maybe it's not a loss. I would like them to release Shea Stadium. The Shea Stadium concert, which was a TV special back then. I would like them to release the Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah, that's surprising that they haven't,
which
actually.
the Beatles are famous for hating them and thinking that they were awful. But it's been so long, they're now a piece of history,
right,
and they should view them that way.
Right.
So I've always been a Beatles fan. When I was like 12, I was into The Who, and oddly enough, I was a big Who fanatic. And then The Who led me to the Beatles, reading about them and stuff. And there is a fan convention that you can attend. It's every spring in New York, and it's every summer in Chicago, and it's called Beatlefest. But to show you how litigious...
The festival, right? Oh, sorry.
No.
That's where you're going.
That's
okay.
The joke.
Yeah.
That Apple's lawyers are famously litigious, and the guy who's in charge of Beatlefest, they took him to court, and they forced him to change it to the Fest for Beatles fans. So now, every spring, I go to the Fest for Lobster fans at Red Lobster. I don't know where this is going. I've been a really big Beatles fan forever. I think this summer is the 32nd Beatlefest I've ever been to. I once went to a Beatlefest in Atlanta where I was the Beatlefest trivia champion, and you had to answer 100 question open-ended tests just to make the game
Holy
show
God.
Part. And apparently, this is what I was told, you had to get every one of the 100 questions. I mean, because think, I mean,
right.
these are,
right.
they have to draw the line somewhere. But they had us all up on stage in the ballroom, and they were asking questions. It was like a TV game show. And I believe the question I won on has something to do with A Hard Day's Night. When the Beatles were touring in France in 63, they were playing at night, and they were writing the songs for Let It Be during the day, and they needed a grand piano in their room, and there was no way to get the grand piano in their room, so they had to bring it up outside the building on a hoist and bring it in through the window. And the question that I won on was, what was the name of the hotel? And, of course, that's an easy question.
Sure.
Because anyone
yeah.
who's even...
I thought it was going to be, what was the name of the hoist?
Probably fine.
What was the name
too.
Of the hotel?
The Hotel George Sink.
Naturally.
But everyone knows that.
Yeah.
Don't they?
Of course.
So, yeah.
I knew it. I just...
I go way back with the Beatles.
Yeah.
One of my bathrooms in Casa de JB is Beatles-themed, and you should see it. When you're sitting on the throne, the Beatles throne, you can actually look at the original British one sheet for Hard Day's Night
yeah.
that's up in the bathroom. So, yeah, I really like the Beatles. And going back to what we were talking about how many times this has come out, because it came out on VHS, and it came out on Laserdisc. Famously, it was a Criterion collection,
yeah.
Laserdisc, that was amazing. Why they didn't retain the rights to do DVD. There's a real big problem, though, with seeing Hard Day's Night, and this is something that I fight with myself, because I'm schizophrenic, every semester. The one right version doesn't exist.
Okay.
So you have to choose between some compromises. The new DVD that you watched
mm-hmm.
is widescreen.
Right.
It is not a widescreen film.
Okay.
It was made in 64. It was made in black and white on a low budget. That film is not widescreen. It's Academy ratio at best. And so they cropped the top and the bottom. And that's a problem. But the version that you saw has the correct soundtrack.
Okay.
And for those of you who are really into this or crazy, the scene to watch to see if they have the right soundtrack is when they walk onto the television studio and they start playing a song, and their sort of road manager puts a little amp on a stand, and George leans into the amp and it kind of falls. And it's during the song. On the gray version, it makes a noise.
Okay.
Because for 10 years, that noise wasn't there. Because what happened in 1982 is Miramax bought the rights and re-released it theatrically. I saw this at the Woodfield One when it came out.
Wow.
And they added this little prologue to it.
Good.
I think it's a special feature on
yeah.
the DVD, where it's all sorts of photographs of the Beatles to I'll Cry Instead. And the idea was in 82, it was kind of a tribute to Lennon because he had just died. The Miramax version took the film and substituted the record music tracks and dolbified it
mm-hmm.
so that the music was nice and loud. But that's a problem, because on every version after that, you have this crummy, low-budget mono soundtrack, and then the minute they put
it... I was noticing this today as I was watching it, that the dialogue was hard to hear.
Oh, my God.
And then they would play a song, and it was like, holy shit, it's a Beatles concert in my basement.
And it's a real problem.
So, I had no idea that there was a real reason for that.
Maybe 10 years ago, this guy named Paul Rutan did a restoration.
P. Roots, got it.
Which they later showed on, it was originally on American Movie Classics, back when American Movie Classics was like Turner Classic, it wasn't what it is now.
Wasn't showing Poseidon.
Yeah. So that version has the right aspect ratio and is beautiful, but has the wrong soundtrack. Now, this has been an interminable story, but here's my point. When I was a kid, they used to show this on Channel 9. They used to show it a lot.
Yeah.
I think this was one of the many instances where I took a little cassette recorder and I taped it off of television so that I could listen to it over and over and over and listen to the dialogue and not just the music. When they showed it on Channel 9, I think they were actually doing a telecine thing where they were showing a 16mm print and broadcasting it.
Okay.
Because it looked awful and it sounded awful, but perfect. in the sound, the crummy mono soundtrack of the dialogue matched the crummy mono soundtrack of the music, and it was all of a piece.
Right.
No version anymore is all of a piece. And when the gray version came out, the one you saw, people were screaming, give us an option of the original mono soundtrack.
Yeah.
Because apparently, and at this point my research fails, there were different mixes and different versions of the songs that were used for the movie. So when Miramax takes the record and layers the record over it, that's wrong.
Right.
I always thought it was just because I was listening through crappy TV speakers that it sounded different.
Yeah.
But it didn't, because the minute that 82 Miramax thing came out,
it
was super hi-fi.
And we've talked about this before.
So which version do I show in class? I have the Paul Rutan restoration on a DVD of questionable legality, which also contains the You Can't Do That documentary.
Oh. I don't know. I you know, there are certain things I'm very precious about. I don't know that I'm... Like with Universal Monsters we talked about back in October, that Beatles fans in particular are very specific about things like mixes, and is this true to this thing, correct? I'm not mistaken there, right?
There's endless, endless bootlegs, the most famous being a series called Every Little Thing. I think now it's 12 discs of every single variation in Paraguay.
But life is too short.
There's an extra...
Are you really going to listen to everyone?
Well, I have.
Okay.
There's an extra hi-hat on the intro to All My Loving. Oh, my goodness!
I don't get it.
Because their work is finite?
Sure.
We don't...
We keep finding ways
to a way to make this new and different.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
So here's my question for you.
Yes, sir.
Because you just saw it today.
Yes.
And I saw it maybe 3 weeks ago with a large group of young people.
And 100 other times.
Easily. Every Beatle Fest
starts
with a screening of Hard Day's Night. And you haven't lived until you've been in the big ballroom at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare with maybe 800 people who know this film like the back of their hands. It's something, let me tell you. Does it hold up?
Yeah. I think it does.
See, I think it does.
Yeah, I think it does.
And on the documentary, You Can't Do That, which I recommend, Ebert is one of the talking heads, because Ebert loved this film.
Mm-hmm.
And he says one of the reasons why he thinks it holds up is because it's in black and white.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Because that makes it timeless.
Right, and it has sort of this documentary feel. So while you feel like you're watching a snapshot of 1964,
a day in the life of the Beatles,
you also feel like it's current. The dialogue is so fast and quippy that
it's weirdly stylized, though.
Sure,
it sounds like half sort of gutter Liverpool slang and half Shakespeare. There's things in this film. Don't be cheeky. I'll bind him to me with promises.
Yeah, there's, I mean, not everything.
Ringo's very fussy about his drums. They loom large in his legend. I mean, it's very strange. In fact, for the longest time, I couldn't figure this out, and then I finally did. There's this expression they say 100 times in the film.
Okay.
Gumhead.
All right.
What?
Yeah.
Gumhead. And watching the film over and over, please note, I haven't yet been on the Wikipedias to verify this. Apparently, in England at the time, a popular expression was come ahead, which was their version of come on.
Okay.
Come on, guys.
Got it.
Did you notice this?
No.
They say it a lot.
Yeah.
Because of their accents, come ahead. And that just, it was very, very strange. But for the most part, I love the dialogue in this because, again, it's the Beatles saying, we don't want to do this. We want to make it different. But that leads to my next question. It's in black and white.
Yes.
It follows the Beatles on a typical day. He's making air quotes in his hands. But then there's other things in the film that deliberately exist to make you question that. And Lester said he did that on purpose. Mm-hmm. He did that deliberately. And the first example is they're in the little train compartment with the stuffy guy who's a pain in the ass. And they leave the compartment, and then suddenly they're outside the train,
mm-hmm.
running alongside the train, one of them on a bicycle.
Right.
Mister, can we have our ball back?
Right.
That can't happen.
Correct.
So is this film, besides being the father of MTV?
Yes.
MTV actually claimed that.
Sure.
They gave Richard Lester a certificate
cool.
calling him the father of MTV.
Wow.
He insisted.
I thought the father of MTV was Michael Nesmith.
Well, I thought it was Bob Pittman, but that's deep cut.
Michael Nesmith actually did sort of invent MTV.
No, very definitely, with yeah. elephant parts and his little music videos.
But he's the one who said, you should do this. I just read a whole book about it. But anyway.
The story goes that they gave, at one of their many award ceremonies that exist for a TV show, they yeah. gave Lester a certificate calling him the father of MTV. And now I'm going to screw up the joke,
because right.
the joke's dependent on one word.
Okay.
Sing a Beatles song, I'll think of it.
I know. I will not. I don't know any Beatles.
You're worried
songs.
About those lawyers? You know Beatles songs.
Not a one. Not a one.
Your son has a Beatles t-shirt.
That's true. He has several.
Boy, it's... Oh, I got it.
All right.
They gave Richard Lester a certificate. You are the father of MTV. And Lester said, I insist on a paternity test.
Good one, Lester.
That's the joke. But I often wonder if A Hard Day's Night maybe... coming from Lester's background and then the films that he would go on to make, if in a small way, A Hard Day's Night started magic realism, because there's things in that film that fit very comfortably into what we would later call that style, too.
And again, I think that's part of creating a cult of personality of the Beatles, that their lives are so wacky and sort of silly that they can break the bounds of reality. You know what I mean? It was the same thing watching this movie, and I like A Hard Day's Night, and I love the Beatles. I don't have complaints about A Hard Day's Night, but it doesn't hit me as much as it hits other people. It's a movie that I sort of appreciate, but I am not often compelled to just put on, even though I love the photography. And it to me, a little bit, it suffers from Apocalypse Now syndrome, which is that opening... you're convinced, well, this is the best thing ever made, and then the rest of it isn't the same for me, and A Hard Day's Night, that opening is so great that, so I was watching it thinking, well, how come I don't connect to this movie as much as some other movies, and I thought about the Monkees movie, Head, which I love, and then I thought, well, Head wouldn't exist without the Monkees TV show, and the Monkees TV show certainly wouldn't. I mean, all they're doing is A Hard Day's Night. They're just ripping off A Hard Day's Night wholesale. And the Monkees used to do nonsense like that
yes.
all the time. And again, it's sort of this, you're creating this fiction for these people, for teenagers to see, like, oh gosh, the Beatles are so wacky that they can run alongside the train, and isn't this fun? I don't remember where I was going with that, but I to me, it's all of a piece. You know what I mean? I don't think the movie ever really pushes the sort of realistic documentary angle too hard. Because you get the woman falling into the puddle. I mean, there's all sorts of things that break with the...
That never fails to get a big laugh.
The reality, yeah.
And every time I watch it, every semester I think the same thing. It's the rule of threes. It's the perfect right. example of the rule of threes.
Better joke, she doesn't come back up.
Well, what I think is the secondary joke is, and this film's 50 years old, let's spoil it. when Ringo
they
goes,
make the show, it's a big hit. John Lennon is murdered.
That took a turn. That when Ringo has his little walkabout, he's trying to be gallant, and he's laying down his coat in this muddy patch for this woman to walk over, because apparently that's something that people used to do. And he does it once, and he does it twice, and then the third time he does it, she falls down an enormous hole and goes completely off, out of frame. When she comes out of the hole, there's a guy there in the hole. That there already was a guy
right.
in the hole.
Right.
He's wearing a suit.
Right.
And the two of them turn and look around. I mean, I would love to see what the next 5 seconds of that is, that we have to stop meeting like this. It looks like there's a line that was cut, but it's so weird that the joke is boom, boom, boom.
Right.
And then Lester decides, well, let's put another guy in the hole. It seems.
Which is a funny joke. And then that joke is straight out of like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And in some ways, I think Bugs Bunny was almost an antecedent to this movie because of the way that these guys are the smartest, quippiest guys in the room, and they can do these crazy things like run alongside the train. I mean, that's Bugs Bunny.
They're certainly quippy. You had mentioned the monkeys, and I agree that the monkeys wouldn't exist without the Beatles. No. If you look at the things that were part of the TV show, though, that made the TV show what it is, I actually thought what the TV show is aping is Help.
Okay.
Not only in its visual aesthetic and,
sure.
and breaking the fourth wall and a lot of words on the screen.
Sure.
My favorite is, you know, at one point in every Monkees episode, they would be chased. And that
right.
gives you an opportunity for crazy editing and little jokes and a song. And at one point, they're being chased around a hotel. And Peter takes a second to stop the chase to steal some towels. And the screen freezes, and on the screen there's the words, "Everybody does it," that kind of thing. That's from Help,
sure.
including, if you think about it, the crazy, I mean, maybe if you were 12, you would think, yeah, I'm going to get my own place and live with my friends. The monkeys are shown sharing this crazy apartment. At the beginning of Help, they go through separate doors, and we discover it's this playpen
right.
for Beatles. So.
Right.
I like the monkeys.
Sure.
Don't get me wrong.
Right.
Dandruff and Victor Mature's head, I'm on board for that. But the monkeys owes a lot to the Beatles.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back to the sort of the all the gags, a couple of weeks ago I wrote a thing about Richard Donner, and it got me thinking about Superman versus Superman 2. And for a long time growing up, I always thought Superman 2 was the better movie. It's not. At all. And part of the problem with Superman 2, a big part of the problem, is Richard Lester, who sort of came on after Richard Donner was fired and reshot a bunch of material so that he could get sole directing credit. And one of the things he did was add all these stupid gags that are sort of at odds with the rest of the movie. That we have General Zod, he's very menacing, we have Superman, he's very sincere, and then we have this guy's toupee blowing off, and a guy who's still talking on the phone as he gets blown down the street. All of the things that I don't like about what Richard Lester did in Superman 2 are what make A Hard Day's Night great. It's just gag after gag after gag, and then we stop, and here's a song that's as classic as Happy Birthday, you know? It's,
yeah.
And that's one of the things that I think is amazing about A Hard Day's Night, is not only the chance to see the Beatles play music that you can't even wrap your head around how a human being wrote this song.
Right, and I think in the film, at least for me, that's exemplified. At one point, they sort of settle down, and they sing, "If I Fell."
Mm-hmm.
That song is so beautiful. And yet, if you listen to the lyrics, so mature in terms of the point of view of, this is not your standard 12-year-old love lament. It's talking about, we're falling in love, but we have to acknowledge that I'm leaving someone behind who's going to be very hurt by this. And I think in 1964, this was something new.
Right.
This wasn't Let Me Be Your Teddy Bear
right.
or even Heartbreak Hotel.
Right.
This was pretty sophisticated.
Yeah.
And that sophistication is matched by the melody and those harmonies they hit. It's
amazing. And that's one of dozens of songs that they wrote that are all on that level. I mean, it's a miracle.
And this is how we define genius. And I know there's always some people who can't wrap their heads around it, or the people who say that Shakespeare didn't write his plays, or that some people even claim...
What was that movie called?
Anonymous. That some people claim that the Beatles could not have written their songs. Well, that's why it's genius, because we can't wrap our head around it.
Right.
The Beatles basically wrote the 13 songs that they wrote for Hard Day's Night. They're not all in the movie.
Right.
In 2 weeks. They were under a deadline. And Richard Lester said, I sat down and they played me the songs. And in one afternoon, I had to pick which ones are going to be in the movie and which ones are not going to be in the movie. So imagine that.
Right.
Because another reason to seek out this documentary I was talking about, and it's where the documentary gets its title, they filmed one more number.
You can't do that.
For the scene at the end. And you can, I'm sure that's on YouTube. And Lester thought the concert was too long, which my students would agree. That tests their patience at the end. Even though it's a medley. I mean, songs cut off.
Yeah, they do.
And then fade back in.
Again, that sequence, while great now, especially as a Beatles fan, like, hey, I get to watch the Beatles play live, does seem to exist more for audiences in 1964. This was their way to go to a Beatles concert.
You've had the narrative,
right,
and now here's the bonus concert. But really, if you consider, and I'm not second-guessing Lester, if he's sitting down that afternoon picking songs, the concert as it exists in the finished film is the best of what we've just heard.
Right.
Imagine if the concert were 5 songs we haven't heard yet.
Yeah.
Because clearly they're keeping She Loves You in reserve. We don't hear that during the film, and that's the punch.
Yeah.
They filmed You Can't Do That. It's available on the documentary. But another thing I like about the documentary is they knew they had this footage that people would want to see. Hey, would you like to see the missing number from Hard Day's Night? Would I? But that's the theme of the documentary, that throughout the filming, there was a feeling of, you can't do that, that Lester and company were doing things that had never been done, and they were being told that. The greatest example of this, and I was marveling at this shot 3 weeks ago when I was watching it. I'm hoping you were marveling too this morning. Paul is singing And I Love Her, which is really self-contained. That's really a music video. Mm-hmm. And Lester said he wanted the camera to sort of go 180 degrees around McCartney's head, but they had no way of doing it. So they took some very heavy rope, and they attached it to the ceiling, and they put the camera in a swing, and they had two guys walk it around Paul, knowing that the rope would keep it relatively still.
Right.
And as it goes around his face and he's singing, you get lens flare.
Right.
There's this very bright light that completely obscures him until they move around, and then it's like a lunar eclipse. His face, I mean, it is a beautiful shot that calls attention to himself.
Yeah.
The first time they showed it to the United Artists executives, they said, that's a mistake. You have to get rid of that.
But that's one of the reasons I think the movie still holds up. Any movie that does things that are sort of way ahead of its time stands a much, much better chance, I think, of being timeless.
And I'm just old-fashioned enough, and it happens twice in the film, where Grandpa, which is the film's plot engine.
Yeah.
That's Wilford Bramble, by the way, when the film was made.
Great British name.
He was maybe more famous than the Beatles, at least among certain people. He was on a very popular English situation comedy called Steptoe and Son that years later is imported to the United States and becomes Sanford and Son. It's about this irascible old man who owns this junkyard. It happens twice in the film. Bramble is going around and getting lost and getting into trouble, and he comes up through this trapdoor.
Yeah.
And I give the Beatles so much credit because it's during the final concert sequence. Right. This old man comes up through the floor, tips his hat, and I think it's Paul who like grabs him and pulls him. Or is it George?
I want to say it's George, but you've seen it more than
one of them grabs him.
It all happens really fast.
Yeah, and one of them kicks him. And it's like, it's so
does that
fun and humble of them to say this is good enough that it's that the musical number is not sacrosanct.
To stick a gag, in the middle of, does that shot, which to me, the first time you see the wide shot of them on the stage, and obviously that thing you do, which we mentioned, apes that very much, does that work on the Academy ratio version?
It's surprising how well this film adapts to fake widescreen.
Yeah.
If you had never seen it square, there's a couple things that you suddenly notice, but it's not nearly as bad as there's some fake HD channels on our on our cable system. Mm-hmm. They're not HD, but the films have been zoom boxed, and I can spot that instantly. I turn it on, and I'm like, no director on earth would cut someone's head off. Like, well, there have been directors who have decapitated people, but that's not the purpose of this podcast. You know, the framing. The framing. And Paul's grandfather coming up through the floor is really the fruition of all the jokes with the TV director. Because for that to happen during a... The next shot is we cut to him, like, having a conniption in the control booth. Mm-hmm. In fact, when the concert's over, we see that production assistant massaging his shoulders. And I bring this up because Victor Spinetti is a very fine actor. He's the only actor who was in every Beatles film, because he's in Help as the crazy scientist, and he's in Magical Mystery Tour, too. Victor Spinetti is the greatest guest they have ever had at Beatlefest, ever. Because every year you go to Beatlefest.
The festival for Beatles fans.
The Fest for Lobster fans. And they have these guests. And sometimes the guest is terrific. Harry Nilsson came to a couple of them and had great stories. And sometimes the guest is... One year they had Patty Boyd. Boy, you think she'd have some stories to tell, wouldn't you?
Right?
Yeah, at 17. That's where she and George met.
Yeah.
At that point in the film, I always freeze the frame. And this annoys the hell out of them. I tell them the story that they met on the film and they later got married. And she later divorced George for Eric Clapton. And that girl is the inspiration for
Layla,
Wonderful Tonight, and Something.
Yeah, right. Wow. Wow, yeah.
Patty Boyd was one of the worst Beatlefest guests ever. But Spinetti used to come about every 5 or 6 years. And imagine this. He's an actor. He likes the spotlight. He's a raconteur. He has stories to tell. And he's really good at telling them and can actually do the four voices.
Nice.
It was an hour of, can we just...
Right.
Can you just talk? And because this is much better than the flea market or seeing A Hard Day's Night for the 176th time. And I think the people behind Beatlefest got feedback. Oh, my God, you have to have him back. Because many years later, they did a Beatlefest in Las Vegas when Love opened that Cirque du Soleil show. And I took my family to Vegas. And this was years later. And Spinetti was not in good health. Mm. And he was at the end of his career. And the entire thing was like them trying to recreate the magic of his earlier appearances. Yeah. They had someone on stage like prompting him to tell these stories. And it reminded me, when the Beatles broke up from 1970 to 1980, when John was assassinated, the big question was, are you guys ever going to get together? Why don't you guys get together? Because God knows they didn't give everything for 10 years, and George once said that they gave up their nervous systems to be Beatles, and they gave you everything, and 13 albums that'll change your life, that'll make life better.
Yes.
But that's not enough, because we need just one more. That Paul always used to say that for years, Paul's little offhand answer was, it would be like reheating a souffle.
Yeah.
You can't.
This is a terrible example.
That's what they were doing with Victor Spinetti.
Right.
And I almost wish I hadn't gone to Vegas.
Right. Because you would just have the other thing in your memory. Yeah.
My wife wanted me to bring this up.
All right.
Years ago, this was a long time ago, this was at the beginning of David Letterman as a late night host, where they used to do really weird things. They don't really do really weird things anymore. Back then, man, they did weird things. One night they had a pop song. They didn't tell you what the pop song was, but they had a series of translators on the stage, and they gave the English lyrics to a man who translated it from English into Spanish. And this was during the show. This was a running joke during the show. And then translator number one would hand it to translator number two, who only got it in Spanish, translated it into German, and then handed it to the third guy, and on and on. Right. I think they did 5 or 6 languages.
And then eventually back into English, I'm guessing?
Back into English, and then at the end of the show, they handed it to Paul Schaefer to perform. And the song was A Hard Day's Night.
Ah.
And it was really funny. It was so funny that my wife and I remember it to this day. Translated from language to language to language to language. It's been the night of a very hard day. And I've been working as a dog.
Yeah, well, how would that translate? It's a made-up expression.
It's an idiom. It's
right.
But I have found employment as a dog.
One of the, we talked about the concert, and obviously one of the charms of the movie is the ability to go back and sort of experience the throes of Beatlemania. And Robert Zemeckis in the late 70s made I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I like Robert Zemeckis, and I Want to Hold Your Hand is fine, although I've never loved it, because I always felt
I
like...
I love it.
I always felt like it spent 90 minutes trying to recreate exactly what you get in the last 15 minutes of A Hard Day's Night, and that's sort
true,
of...
True, but should that be held against a film that's not Hard Day's Night? The whole frenzy surrounding the Beatles, yeah. Some of the secondary characters, oh my God, she's in RoboCop.
Nancy Allen.
When Nancy Allen gets into the hotel room, that yeah. shot of the sure. guitar, that makes me laugh.
It's fine.
And that's one of the few movies where Eddie Deason makes me laugh.
Yeah.
He's the Beatles expert.
Oh, I know who Eddie Deason is. I just felt like it was 90 minutes of what this thing already does better in a shorter amount of time. But
the other thing I like as a Beatles fan about I Want to Hold Your Hand, which I would recommend, is they actually spent the money, which was cheaper back then, yeah. let me tell you, yeah. to get the rights
right.
so that we don't have this nonsense. There was one other thing. Oh, yes. Back to the title song.
Yes.
Shenson tells his story in the documentary. I think it's another example of how they were geniuses. They didn't have a title for the film. For the longest time, it was Beatles Number One. Nobody knew what to call it.
Beatles 1964.
Hey, it could have gone out with that title. For a few weeks, Help, before they wrote the song, was called Eight Arms to Hold You.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the rarer Beatles artifacts is the song Ticket to Ride went out, the first issue of the single, Ticket to Ride, from the upcoming Beatles film, Eight Arms to Hold You.
Wow.
Yeah, which actually makes sense, because at the end of that film, there's the big Indian idol, which mm-hmm. has eight arms. For the longest time, they were calling this Beatles Number One. Beatles Number One. And Ringo came up with the title, because he was the master of malapropisms, and said they had been recording all night, and he said that was A Hard Day's Night, and apparently someone from the film said, title! And that was the title. Shenson took Lennon and McCartney aside and said, if we're going to call it Hard Day's Night, and notice they don't perform it in the film,
yeah.
it's layered over the opening credits, they said, we need a song called A Hard Day's Night. And Lennon McCartney said, I don't see how that could be a song. What could that be? And Shenson, who's not musical, said, it's A Hard Day's Night and I Love You. And that was no help at all. Lennon and McCartney go to the pub that night. And the next morning, they ask Shenson into the dressing room. They pull out a cocktail napkin and they play it for him.
Assholes.
This is a number one yeah, hit song. Right. It's like you said, it's like Happy Birthday. Yeah. It's iconic.
Yeah.
And they wrote it on demand.
Yeah.
You give them five words. Oh, here you go.
And it's so sad the way that things eventually went with the band, and that there was all this bad blood, and that they only lasted 10 years. But like you said, had they not... Who knows? Maybe it would have gotten worse.
We need to be happy for the 10 years because I know...
We have this perfect little closed loop.
Earlier, oh, very definitely. In fact, as a Beatle fan, I wish when they were doing Let It Be, the idea was we're going to get back to our roots. None of this overproduction and psychedelica of Sgt. Pepper, which is going to be the four of us, well, five with Billy Preston in the studio. And they went back to the EMI building, and they made a photograph that looked exactly like the photograph on the cover of Please Please Me. And the idea was it was going to be called Get Back with Let It Be and 22 other songs, whatever it was. And it was going to look exactly like their first album, and I so wish they would have done yeah. that. Because they later recycled the picture on those popular red and blue greatest hits albums.
Right.
They later used the idea.
Right.
But that really would have been closing the loop. Earlier I mentioned Shakespeare, And often in school, I teach Shakespeare to my English classes, and I tell my kids, we came very close to not having these at all. This was a long time ago, and plays were not published, and these weren't published until after his death. If Shakespeare's friends hadn't gotten together and said, maybe we should publish these, they could have easily been lost to history. So again, I think we have to look at, they gave everything, and they made the most incredible music. I think it's 267 songs. I used to know that by heart. Why can't we just be happy with this?
Yeah.
When are you guys getting back together?
Right.
You're awful. You're selfish.
So that we can all be disappointed and complain. It's a terrible analogy, but we complain for 8 years that we want more Arrested Development. They put it up on Netflix, and immediately people say, it's no good anymore. It's like, well, you asked for this.
I've been watching them, and I'm finding them variable. I think the quality of the new ones varies much more wildly than the original show.
Sure.
That's
I would agree with
where
that.
I am. One more recommendation.
Yes.
Patrick mentioned, had they
you
ever...
You should listen to the Beatles. That's the recommendation, right?
Your life will be improved to the extent that you listen to the Beatles.
I think you guys might like them.
There's a wonderful book. It's now out of print. It's by Mark Shipper. It's called Paperback Writer. It's a stitch. It's the alternate history of the Beatles. The whole book seems researched, but it's all a joke.
I
I'll give you an example.
This.
No. None. It's hilarious. In Shipper's version, the Beatles' first album is called We're Gonna Change the Face of Rock and Roll History Forever.
I mean, that works as like an Onion article.
No. This is a feat that he pulls off. The reason I bring it up is, in Shipper's book, they get back together. And it's a debacle of biblical proportions.
Right.
They wind up being Peter Frampton's opening act because they can't sell enough tickets on their own. And they put out one more album, which is execrable.
It's called Free as a Bird.
Don't get me started.
Again, people for years complain, more Beatles music. Here you go. It's Free as a Bird and Real Love. You're welcome.
They use that as the bait to get people to watch the documentary.
Did they need bait to get people to watch that documentary?
I think for a lot of people it was bait because I remember...
That's insane.
When Anthology 1, when the CDs for Anthology 1 came out, people were put off by the fact that the first couple cuts are like archival and crude. And apparently,
it's like reading a biography. You got to get through the stuff.
But people want to pop it in and listen to it, and it's not. It's a history lesson. It's not pop music.
Right.
So apparently, this made them rethink the second one, because the running order was announced, and thousands, if not tens of thousands, of those little booklets were printed. And at the last minute, they changed the running order of the second one, responding to the archival distaste for the first one.
Hmm. Anyway, Hard Day's Night is a classic. For good reason.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love the scene with John in the bathtub.
Watch it for Rock and Roll Day.
Yes.
I'll be watching Rock and Roll High School. Thanks for listening, everybody. Keep posting for Junesploitation, and we'll see you next week.
Come, Ed.